Here on CFMU 93.3, I'm your host, Waraz Sheikh, and today we have a special show packed with insightful discussions, deep cultural dives, and reflection on the path forward for Sudan. From exploring our rich history to diving into the contemporary challenges of our nation, we'll cover all of it here today. Let's begin on our journey together. CFMU 93.3. Thank you for tuning into our program today. We will now cover our political pulse segment. And to start off with this week's political pulse segment, I would like to quickly brief you on the updates from Sudan and the war that is ongoing. So as of October 31st, clashes between the Rapid Support Forces and the armed forces in Al-Fashir North continue. RSF rampage on Jazeera State continues for the 11th consecutive day, including mass displacement of civilians. Per a report by the UN yesterday, an estimated 120,000 people have been displaced in the last 10 days. Yes, that is the last 10 days alone, 120,000 people have been displaced. 11 million people are reportedly internally displaced in Sudan, with over 3 million extremely displaced externally as refugees. The world's largest displacement crisis is officially the war in Sudan. In other news, the Rapid Support Forces continue to impose siege on Wad al-Fadl village in East Al Jazeera, where they detained residents in mosques, looted properties, set fire to hospitals and homes, and resulted in the killing of 6 civilians. From earlier this week, the RSF rampage in Al Jazeera state included attacks on the village of Al-Hilaliya, in which 5 civilians were killed. Along that timeline, airstrikes and clashes between the SAF and the RSF continued in Al-Fashir state. The RSF drone strikes on residential areas in Omdurman still continue, as well as SAF airstrike on positions held by the RSF in Jabal Awliya in Khartoum state. Now, the RSF attack on villages in West Kordofan state resulted in additional deaths in that region. 10 civilians were confirmed to be killed. Homes, shops were looted and burned, as we continue to see whenever the RSF enter a new area. In a new report, the UN fact-finding mission said RSF are responsible for committing sexual violence on a large scale in areas under their control, including gang rapes and abducting and detaining victims in conditions that amount to sexual slavery. Now, the news of these current sieges by the RSF in areas of Al Jazeera state is quickly being shared in social media. Different members of the Sudanese community are telling stories of their family members who are currently entrapped in these villages that are being attacked by the RSF. One po- post talked about an individual from Al-Siriha and all her family that are in that village. She mentioned that on her dad's side, every single man in her family was killed. So we can clearly see that there is a mass elimination of entire families and entire histories. Sudan's Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF's paramilitary, massacred more than 124 civilians and injured 200 more in the state of Al Jazeera as of earlier last week. They raped, looted, burned, and murdered people over 5 days. Medics say the true deaths toll from the war in Sudan could be upwards to 150,000. Just to put that into perspective, when we are comparing the ongoing violence that we're seeing in Palestine, we know that it's reported to have resulted in the death of 40,000 Palestinians. So if you want to understand the scale of what is happening in Sudan, you can compare the 40,000 that have been confirmed dead in Palestine to the 150,000 that have been confirmed dead in Sudan due to these RSF attacks. And you can also, in line, compare the media coverage that is being provided to Sudan versus Palestine and other regions. To conclude our Political Pulse segment for this week, I want to draw to your attention to an art showcase that is describing the situation of Sudanese women during these times of war. It is called Mihera, and what you see in the art showcase, which is essentially a photograph of a Sudanese bride, which is split into two pieces. One, the bride is beautifully decorated in all of her jewelry and makeup, and the other side of the picture you see the same bride just as equally beautifully decorated but with bruising and scarring on her face. So Mihera, on the threshold of happiness, only to have it ripped away by genocide. Although Mihera is fictional, her story reflects the reality faced by many Sudanese brides. In Sudan, weddings have turned into scenes of sorrow. The fear of attacks forces brides to give up their dreams of celebration. The name Mihera, which means skill and ability, is beloved in Sudan and reflects the bravery and strength of Sudanese women. Mihera is not just a bride, but a symbol of Sudanese women who embody courage, intelligence, and resilience. They are pillars of their communities, driving them forward. The legacy of the poet Mihera embodies courage and creativity. She used her talent to highlight women's issues, inspiring new generations, and her poems express a collective voice for Sudanese people, making her a symbol of the struggle for justice. If you want to learn and read more about this, we encourage you to follow the hashtag on Instagram for this art piece, so you can look at the cast of It's Arwa Ahmed, so at It's Arwa Ahmed, as well as the director, writer, and producer, which is at Mu'min Ghahani. So at Mu'min Ghahani and at It's Arwa Ahmed.
وطن بعز وامجاد، وطن بيعنه أسياد، وطن بعز وامجاد، وطن بيعنه أسياد، وعماره وخير للوافي أذل يفوتوا أولاده. وطن ما بيشبه الأوطان، وي
ليس يجدي قد مللنا كل من غير الذي يبتل يبدي قد كرهنا طولة الجاهل إن الجهل يرد ليست الثورة تهليلا وتقبيلا للفرد ليست الثورة تدعيما وتكريسا لقيدي أو هتافا أرزقيا مصلة السيف لكيدي إنما الثورة أيد فوق أيد فوق أيدي إنما الثورة جهد بعد جهد بعد جهد إنما الثورة حب وعطاء وتحدي لقلاع الجهل للفقر والداء الألد لشرور النفس للحقد وجور المستبد
We will be talking about one of the lesser known but incredibly important periods in Sudan's history, and that is the Funj Sultanate. Established in the 16th century, the Funj was an Islamic state in what is now known as Central Sudan. It marked a period of relative stability and prosperity for the region, with the Sultanate overseeing a vast empire that extended across much of the Nile Valley. The Funj was notable for its rich cultural synthesis, blending Islamic traditions with indigenous Sudanese customs. The region became a center for Islamic learning and trade, with scholars and merchants traveling across Africa and the Middle East. Despite internal struggles and external pressures, the Funj helped shape Sudan's cultural and identity. The remnants of this great era can still be felt today in the architectural traditions and religious practices of Central Sudan. The legacy of the Funj lives on in the resilience and cultural richness of the Sudanese people. Let's listen to this brief documentary on this great empire.
The Funj Sultanate was an African kingdom located in modern-day Sinnar that existed from 1504 till 1821. The name, Funj, comes from the people that established the kingdom, the Funj, a collection of tribal peoples of unknown ancestry. Located in East Africa, the kingdom held territories in what is now modern-day Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and South Sudan. The kingdom was based around the city of Sana'a, the hub of people, politics, and trade. The kingdom effectively halted Mamluk and Ottoman expansion south for hundreds of years, while creating a region where pre-Islamic and pre-Christian African traditions continued to exist after they had disappeared elsewhere. The collapse of the Nubian kingdoms at the end of the 1400s sent the Sudan into crisis. The large amounts of migration from Sudanese tribes north, as well as Arab tribes and Mamluks pushing south, meant that the region was a crowded place. Everyone was out for themselves. Conquest, plunder, and glory was the aim of the game, and the Arabs, specifically the Abdalab tribe, looked like they had a good shot at uniting the whole region. Then came the Funj. The Funj entered the scene in around 1500 out of nowhere, and completely changed the regional power dynamic. The Funj pushed into the region and established a capital along the Blue Nile, known as Sana'a, and started conquering those around them. The Funj fought the Arabs and were victorious, making the Abdalab into vassals to guard their northern frontier. There were 28 kings of the Funj, some ruling for decades, others for mere months. So I'll make a separate video for those interested in the fascinating history of the Funj kings. But for now, a quick run-through of 300 years of Funj political history. So, Amara Dunkas was an escaped slave who led the Funj, founded Sana'a, and was their first king. Amara Dunkas' sons then go on to rule the empire. Along comes Dakin the Just, who instigates a range of administrative reforms, the Abdalab revolt, and Funj kings then become puppets of the Arab tribes. Adlan II then rises up and defeats the Arabs, but he is betrayed by his nephew, Badi II, who then takes the throne. Under Badi II, the empire is at its height. A new dynasty comes to power, the Nol dynasty, and then Badi IV loses a big important war, and he has to rely on the Hamaj tribe for support. The Hamaj become the power behind the throne, and the Funj kings and the Hamaj regents fight for power for, oh, I don't know, how about 80 years? Power swaps between Funj kings and the Hamaj regents. There are so many puppet kings, most of whom are called Badi for some reason, and the empire is weakened by civil wars and fails to adopt new military technology. This means that in 1821, the Egyptians effectively walk into the Funj capital, say, "This mine now," and conquer the Funj without firing a shot. Okay, that was a crash course in Funj political history. Like I said, I would highly recommend that you check out my other video about the Funj kings. It makes Game of Thrones look like a tea party. The role of the king in the Funj Sultanate, different to Islamic and Christian kingdoms, as the Funj drew their inspiration for kingship from older African traditions, such as the Shilluk in Ethiopia or even ancient Egypt. The king was a near divine figure, rarely appearing in public, communicating through courtiers and officials, and engaging in specific ceremonial customs, such as not being able to sit while eating. The Funj didn't really have the same idea of private property as in the West or within Islam. Technically, all land was the property of the Funj kings, and it was run and managed by his vassals. The structure of the Funj empire was based along feudal lines. The king was the central authority from which all legitimacy was derived, the king having a series of vassals and governors beneath him. An internal Funge province was governed by a Mac, who commanded a series of local aristocrats and holders of land, known as the Mijil, who then commanded leaders of villages, the Kersi. Outer non-Funge provinces were often conquered from other kingdoms, and were usually given to the previous rulers to serve as vassals, or Mechs. For example, the Abdalab were the Mechs of Quarry. All Mechs and Macs were required once a year to visit Sanaa and pay tribute to the king. The king could create new land titles to give to other groups, and was the only power in the land that could technically condemn a person to death. Each province had a Sid al-Kum, a representative of the king, who was invested with the king's power to act as executioner in the name of the king. Think of the Funge kingdom as being split in two, the internal rule of the Macs and the external rule of the Mechs, with the king being the linking factor that brought the state together. Within the Funge Empire, there was an extremely powerful council that helped the Funge kings rule. The council was made of senior family members, court officials, and important vassals, with Muslim holy men taking a more important position as time went on. The council would meet four times a week, morning and night, to discuss and solve the issues of the day. Critically, the council had two powerful, important roles. The council was able to dethrone the king, and also order his death. This is because succession in the Funge Empire was of great concern. So when the king died, the next king was chosen by the council and by powerful lords, Mechs and Macs. All the king's brothers were often executed so as to provide stability. Of course, many brothers would flee the capital and went into exile and then were often recalled to become the next king. When one of the wives of the king, the Funge kings actually had multiple wives, gave birth to a son, she was set aside to prevent her giving birth to a second son that was the full brother of the first. Daughters were often married off to provincial rulers and aristocrats, building dynastic links within the Funge kingdom, with the Funge king's daughters often effectively running the provinces and regions instead of their Mech or Mac husbands. Now I want to talk about religion and society. The role of religion in the Funge kingdom changed drastically over the years. Amara Dunkas converted to Islam in 1523, and this provided a Muslim facade to the Funge Empire. But, in reality, the Funge were not Muslim, and pre-African traditions were more popular in both the royal court and villages than Islam was. For example, beer and pork were regularly consumed across the empire until the 1700s. The customs of the Funge people also went against Islamic and Christian norms. Funge traditions demanded that women walk bare-chested and men bare-headed. These traditions eventually changed as Islam became more popular and were attacked for being un-Islamic. So understanding this, how did Islam function in the Funge Empire? Sunni Islam became the popular religion of the region in the 1700s. Islam in the Funge was actually more aligned with the Maliki Islamic school of thought. Sana'a became a key location for pilgrims travelling from West Africa and Spain to Mecca, and thus took much of the West African Maliki character from these pilgrims. As time passed, the merchant classes converted to Islam and funded religious scholar groups. Religious schools, who practiced an Islamic form of private property, owned the land and claimed they also held power to deliver justice. This significantly delegitimized the role of the Funge kings and transferred power from the upper levels to the lower levels, to the clergy and merchant classes. Arabic slowly became the lingua franca of the empire, and the king began to claim Arab ancestry through the Umayyad dynasty to legitimize the king's hold on power. Religious scholars became more powerful, receiving protection from the king and positions on the king's council. A religious scholar's voice carried more weight in court than the statements of others, and they were actually exempt from taxation. The beating heart of the Funge Empire was a giant metropolis of trade, people, and politics, the city of Sana'a, the jewel of the Blue Nile. The city was described in the mid-1600s as a large city on the Blue Nile, which is a tributary of the Nile, that had walls of 3 kilometers with 3 large gates defended by 50 cannons surrounded by suburbs. It was an absolute swarm of human activity and trade. There were dozens of mosques and religious buildings, hundreds of shops, as well as inns and coffee houses. There were massive marketplaces that sold goods from all over the world, as well as thousands and thousands of slaves. While we do not have exact population figures, in 1700, Theodore Krump, a Bavarian monk on pilgrimage to Ethiopia, visited the city and stated that after Cairo, it was the largest city in Africa, rivaling any city in Anatolia, Arabia, Persia. The life of the common people was similar to most places in the world at the time. Poor. But in the Funj, they were separated into two groups. You had sedentary farmers who lived along the Nile and fertile areas, growing crops, raising animals, and paying taxes. And you had nomadic groups who travelled along selected regions with large herds, trading with the settled peoples. The Funj Empire had no currency. The system was based on barter, with people using gold, textiles, animals, and other units of trade. Currency was actually used, but only as a form of barter. So for example, in the 1700s, the main form of barter in Funj was actually the Spanish silver peso, which had absolutely flooded global markets in the 1700s with the Spanish mines in the New World. Taxes were placed on peasants' harvest. 1/10 of the total harvest was taxed. Taxes were also placed on water wheels and any land that was rained on. Peasants were required to provide unpaid construction and maintenance work for royal projects and provide part of their animal herd for transport. Weavers and craftsmen were required to provide part of their production as tax to the Funj state. Trade was the lifeblood of the Funj and was directly controlled by the king. The Funj king controlled the export of slaves, which provided huge amounts of income, and was responsible for dispatching royal caravans, technically the only legal way to trade within the Funj Empire. The Funj royalty held a monopoly on the trade of gold, slaves, firearm, cattle, ostrich feathers, and ivory coming in and out of the kingdom. Trade was extremely strict in the north, as they were trading with the Ottoman Empire so that they could collect proper tariffs. But it was more lax in the south, trading with the Ethiopians and the southern kingdoms and tribes. Imperial caravans were under the control of the Funj kings, but individual traders were allowed to accompany the caravans, but had to be registered as imperial agents. This meant that traders had to act first in the interests of the king. There was also a safety net though. If the goods were lost, or stolen, or destroyed, the king would pay for the loss. This gave the merchants an incentive to sign up with the trade caravan. It was a form of insurance. All trade into the Funj had to first go to Sana'a, the only place outsiders could sell their wares in the Funj. Foreigners had to pay a fee to trade in the massive Sana'a markets, as access was strictly regulated. As private ownership increased and the rise of wealthy merchants, the king's control of the royal monopoly absolutely collapsed and moved power further away from the central power of the king to the merchants and religious authorities. The Funj military was an extremely effective fighting force in the early years of the Funj Empire, but it failed to adapt to new technologies, such as gunpowder. The Funj army was based around heavy cavalry, which absolutely ripped through the light cavalry of the Arabs and light infantry and archers of the Nubians in the early years of the Funj. Heavily armed in mail and using large spears as lances, the Funj cavalry proved extremely powerful in the 15 and 1600s. Unfortunately, the Funj military failed to adapt to gunpowder and new modern tactics. Since gunpowder and firearms were under a royal monopoly, only the king was able to access them. This absolutely terrified the Meks and Maks, as they had no access to modern tech and would be unable to protect themselves from the king or force the king to respect their autonomy and authority, which led to a series of revolts. The Funj was not a wheeled society, with animals hauling goods on their backs, and thus cannons became incredibly fixed defensive weapons. Most cannons in the Funj Empire were in Sana'a, on the city walls. Eventually, the Funj military became outclassed by foreign powers and proved little threat and challenge to hostile forces. After decades of civil war and a failure to modernize its military, in 1821, a small Egyptian expedition was sent south by Muhammad Ali to conquer the Funj, and it succeeded without a shot being fired. The Egyptians entered Sana'a, met with the last king of the Funj, Badi VII, and accepted his surrender, and the Funj was incorporated into the Egyptian Empire, then the Ottoman Empire, then the British Empire, and finally is today part of Sudan. You can go and visit Sana'a today. It is a small town. But if you're there, stand back and have a think about how much power and wealth and prestige once flowed through this region. How important this city was in an entire continent inhabited by millions and millions of people, known worldwide for its fame, power, and prosperity.
لك السلطان في قلبي والمختار في حربي. وحدك السلطان في قلبي والمختار في حربي. وأنت النيل في أرضي, أنت النيل في أرضي, وأوطاني فوق شفاهك السمراء, مملكتي وميداني. أيا كلي ويا بعضي ويا زهدي ولذاتي. على كفيك قبلاتي وبين يديك قرباني, على كفيك قبلاتي وبين يديك قرباني. يعني فيك رباني فداك العشق رباني, خيامي فيك رباني فداك العشق رباني. أنا متمرد العينين كلي فيك فداني.
Thank you. Oh, my God, عليه القربى مين اللي بيقدر عليه القربى بهاجر في مدار عينيه الباقي كله عليك أحاتك هنت الأيام أحاتك هنت الأيام وتسلم للفرح عيني
tradition of storytelling. Sudan has a rich oral tradition where stories, myths, and folk tales are passed down through generations. These stories are often contained and filled with moral lessons, cultural values, and historic narratives that define the identity of people. One of the most captivating figures in Sudan's folklore is the Al-Samit al-Sufi, a mystical figure who embodies wisdom and patience. Stories of Al-Samit often revolve around his journeys through the desert, where he encounters trials and tests his faith and resolve. The tales serve as allegorisms for the endurance and resilience of the Sudanese people in the face of adversity. Sudanese storytellers known as Hakawis are revered for their ability to captivate audiences with their words. In modern times, these stories are being preserved through written collections, recordings, and performances, ensuring that the rich tapestry of the Sudanese folklore will continue to be shared for generations to come.
صلى الله بيرف الله بدا الله بسمع صلى الله دربك البراد ولا ما صلى الله بدأ يسيبها وعم يطلع. صلى الله بيعملنا والهدوم مرتع. صلى الله بيقفلنا بداية الله بيسمع. صلى الله دربه بالقرعة ولا مع. صلى الله ده يسيبها وعم يطلع.
أهل العمارة اللي بيضكم فار الأغام والأمال وقلبوا الهر حي يا حي يا حي يا حي يا حي يا حي. أهل العمارة اللي بيضكم فار الأغام والأمال وقلبوا الهر حي يا حي يا حي يا حي يا حي يا حي.
لافة في الأرض روحي لافة في السماء راضي البغيب راضي للدى السماء. حبيب قلبي يا أسمى من السماء من شوق لاركاكم وأبقي دمه. لافة في الأرض روحي لافة في السماء راضي البغيب راضي للدى السماء. حبيب قلبي يا أسمى من السماء من شوق لاركاكم وأبقي دمه.
أهل العمار قلبي دكم فار الأغام والأمال وقلبوا الهر حي يا حي يا حي يا حي يا حي يا حي. أهل العمار قلبي دكم فار الأغام والأمال وقلبوا الهر حي يا حي يا حي يا حي يا حي يا حي.
Thank you for listening to our program today and joining us here on CFMU 93.3. As we continue to face uncertainty and hardship in Sudan, I want to take a moment to remind everyone that even in times of war, hope remains a powerful force. We have seen Sudan rise from difficult times before, and this moment is not different. The strength of our people lies in our unity and our ability to come together as a community and to dream of a future filled with peace. Peace is not just a distant idea. It's something that can be built step by step, whether through small acts of kindness or large efforts in reconciliation. Each of us plays a critical role and is a part in creating a more powerful and peaceful Sudan. Let's hold on to that hope, remembering that every dark night is followed by the dawn. The path for peace may be difficult, but with each step forward, we bring ourselves closer to a brighter future for all Sudanese. Let's continue to strive for unity and support one another in this journey.
خلوني نسافر ابويا لو كان في جاز تليل امشي وازور حبيبي الغالي داير اوفي حق الريل شان يا يابا من يوم روح يا يابا من يوم روح ما جاب لي منه بريد وما قال لي كيف يا زولي كم عامل وراك وحيد
الكم ليش جديد يا يابا ريدنا البريد وشريد لنا ما معاكم كيما سليم من حبيبي العين الكم ليش جديد يا يابا ريدنا البريد وشريد لنا ما معاكم كيما سليم من حبيبي العين
دحين يا يابا ما مشتاق يا يابا ما مشتاق وحيدك يبقى عنده بيدك يحوم في البيت يلعب فيه يمرح في ضراء سعيد يقول لي يما يا حبابة
يما يا حبابة
يا حبابة عندي نشيد يسعدني ويسر بالأمو لك يا يابا يبقى حفيد
جديد يا يابا ريدنا للبريد وشديد لنا ما معاكم كيما لكن من حبيبي بعيد
بريد شديد اللي نبغى كتير
to Sudan and each other remains strong. Let's continue to support one another, work toward peace, and celebrate the beauty of our culture. We'll be back next week with more insights, stories, and music from Sudan. In the meantime, stay connected by visiting our social media platforms for more content and updates. Until next time, I'm your host, Wala Sheikh, wishing you peace and strength. Ma'asalama.
أراك عيان زورني يا حبيبي أنا عيان في الطيف وفي صح عيان زورني يا حبيبي أنا عيان Good.
ترجمة